Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Margaret Nowicki from the Department of Public Information. The annual session of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues opened this morning. The session lasts 2 weeks and will cover issues ranging from Africa, youth, health, education, culture, and human rights to the upcoming 2014 World Conference on Indigenous Peoples. To discuss some of the main themes of the session, we're very pleased to have with us, on my immediate right, the new chairperson of the Permanent Forum, Mr. Paul Kanyinke Sena. Mr. Sena is an indigenous Ogiek from Kenya and was formerly the East Africa Regional Representative in the Indigenous Peoples of Africa Coordinating Committee. He is the first African to chair the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. To Mr. Sena's right is Ms. Andrea Landry, a representative of the Anishinaabe, one of the First Nations of North America. She is currently pursuing her master's degree in communications and social justice at the University of Windsor in Canada. She has been engaged in advocacy and outreach at the local, national, and international levels and is currently the youth executive for the National Association of Friendship Centers. To Ms. Landry's right is Mr. Setareki Makanawai. He is a leading disability advocate in the Asia-Pacific region and currently the CEO of the Pacific Disability Forum, an umbrella organization for more than 20 Pacific-based disabled people's organizations. He also served as executive director of the Fiji National Council for Disabled Persons and as principal of the Fiji School for the Blind. And on his right is Ms. Dali Sambodoro, an Inuit of Alaska. She is a member of the Permanent Forum and also serves as an assistant professor of political science at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. She has been active in the promotion of indigenous rights at the United Nations, the International Labor Organization, the Organization of American States, and other organizations, and has received numerous awards for her work. Each of our panelists will make brief remarks, and then we will take your questions. I would like to begin with Mr. Sena. Mr. Sena, you have the floor.
Good afternoon, everyone. First of all, I would like to thank you for this opportunity. We always appreciate every opportunity that we get to speak about indigenous people's rights. I've been honored to be nominated the chair of this session. And as has just been said, I'm the first African actually to be a chair of the Permanent Forum. So we are just from the opening ceremony, and during that event we had the session included messages from the Secretary General and speeches by the Deputy Secretary General, the Vice President of the General Assembly, and the Vice President of the Economic and Social Council. Participation of this in this year's session is expected to be high because already about 2,300 people, indigenous activists, have pre-registered to attend. It's another issue whether all of them will be able to attend, because I understand a lot had visa issues, but we expect a large number to participate. This is a review year. The 12th session is a review year, and the topics that we will be reviewing are Permanent Forum recommendations on the areas of health, education, and culture. And these are very critical issues for indigenous peoples. We'll also have a session on human rights, and it's in this session we'll have discussions around the implementation of the UN Declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples, and then there'll be a dialogue with the Special Rapporteur on the rights of indigenous peoples, Professor Jim Anaya. We will also have an in-depth dialogue with the international financial institutions. As part of the forum's method of work this year, we'll have this dialogue with these institutions that include the World Bank, and the dialogue with the World Bank is actually very important because they are undergoing a process of reviewing their safeguards policies in relation to indigenous peoples, and as I understand, they are sending the largest ever delegation from the World Bank to the Permanent Forum, about 30 people. So you see how seriously they are taking this session. And we also have the Asian Development Bank and the African Development Bank, which is actually heading now towards including indigenous, developing a standalone policy on indigenous people's issues in the African continent. And this is just a new discussion within the African Development Bank, with the first meeting held only in February this year. So it's and already they are here, which is very important, encouraging. And then we'll have the Inter-American Development Bank and International Finance Corporation. This year, the regional focus of the forum actually will be on the African continent. And we'll have a panel discussion that includes permanent forum members, myself, indigenous organizations, states, and UN agencies. So we expect the special representative of the Secretary General on Africa to be part of the panelists. We have the legal counsel of the President of the Republic of Congo, and we really appreciate that the Republic of Congo, for the first time ever, actually hosted a presidential meeting for the permanent forum in March this year. That was the first ever that an African country has taken that initiative, and we urge other African governments to follow suit and also organize issues around indigenous peoples in their respective countries. Congo also is actually the first country actually globally to design a specific law on indigenous peoples, which is very, very encouraging. So we're just, the issues now of implementation is the subject of discussion now. And of course, we'll have Dr. Albert Barume from the ILO is also part of the panelists on that half-day session on Africa. The focus actually will be looking at pastoralism within the context of a post-2015 development agenda, so that can be very interesting for journalists here. And then we'll also have a discussion on the World Conference, and as you have heard, this conference will take place in September 2014, the high-level event, otherwise known as the World Conference on Indigenous Peoples. And for those of you who may be interested in following up discussions around this World Conference, there will be a preparatory meeting in Alta, Norway from 10th to 12th June, so maybe where Indigenous people will be deliberating on the themes that will be discussed in the September meeting. And then we'll have a discussion on the post-2015 development agenda. As earlier said, there'll be a panel discussion around this theme and how indigenous peoples are being included in this agenda. Some of the speakers we expect to be part of that post-2015 development agenda includes Ambassador Amina Mohammed. She's a Kenyan and now has been nominated as a foreign affairs minister. His Excellency Carsten Thaur of Denmark, John Hendra of the UN Women, and others. So, and of course, there will be a lot of outreach and side events. There will be approximately 70 side events where various issues will be discussed, but around the themes of the forum this year. And with those, say thank you for giving me the few minutes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Senna. Ms. Landry.
Bonjour, Migizio de Kwe Dijnikaz, Makwadodem, Paysebot First Nation, Donjaba, Anishinaabe Kwe Ndao. My name is Andrea Landry. My traditional name is Migizio de Kwe, it means Eagle Heart Woman. I come from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe people in Canada. What I'd like to discuss here is the expert group meeting that was held in January in New York City. The focal point was Indigenous youth with the themes of identity, hopes, and challenges. And we directly focus on Articles 14, 17, 21, and 25 of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We had one representative from each of the socioeconomic regions in the UN system. So we had one from North America, Latin America, Africa, Arctic, and the other regions as well. Within these discussions, it really resulted down to our linguistic sovereignty as Indigenous peoples, and how our languages really provide us a connection to who we are as Indigenous peoples. When we were looking at this, we began to look and have further discussions on how educational systems in the UN states are not thoroughly implementing traditional livelihoods or Indigenous education and languages within the mainstream society. If you go to my community of 60 people in northwestern Ontario, we have one language speaker. That's my great auntie, and she's about 80 years old. I don't have the opportunity to learn my language within my community or even in the urban center. And through this, I feel kind of a disconnect as to who I am as an Indigenous youth. There's also the concept of living in both worlds. If you stay in your community, you learn about your traditions, you learn about your ceremony, you learn about your culture, and you may have the opportunity to learn about your language. But when you're living in this city, it's a matter of getting a Western education. It's a matter of finding a good job. And it's a matter of gaining monetary, financial way of living. So when I went to do my master's, it was up to me to decide what's more important for me, getting my master's degree or learning my language at home. And this was one of the biggest decisions I've ever had to make. And during that time, while I was writing my master's, there was many times where I wanted to back down. I wanted to go back home to my community, to be with my people, to learn my language, to be a part of my culture. Growing up for me as an Indigenous youth in the urban setting, as well as on the First Nations reservation that I'm from, was quite difficult. There were many challenges, whether it was due to poverty, due to access to food, and due to any kind of the abuses that have occurred in the residential school systems in Canada. And this has kind of circulated and transformed into my own upbringing. When I was about 18 or 19 years old, I made the decision to quit drinking, to quit doing drugs, to learn my language, and to start living traditionally. And if it wasn't for that decision, I don't think I would be where I am today. And we see this a lot within a lot of the Indigenous youth that participate in the United Nations mechanisms, more directly the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues or the expert group meeting on Indigenous youth. Indigenous youth are now realizing that their voices are powerful, that their messages have meaning, and that they can create change whether they're 13 years old or whether they're 30 years old. And it's up to us as young people to keep the stories that we've heard from our ancestors, from our grandmothers, from our grandfathers. My grandfather has passed on, but he was a residential school survivor. And because of this, I know that my voice is here for a reason. I'm here for him. Because when he was in that residential school, when he was being sexually and physically abused, he didn't have a voice. My language was not allowed to be spoken by him. And it's my duty as an Indigenous youth to maintain that language, to maintain that culture, and to remind other young people to redefine those stereotypes that we have set in our systems. So when people see me as a Native American, they see me as a drunk, they see me as poor, they see me as lazy, they see me as uneducated, but here I am redefining that stereotype. I'm sober, I'm educated, I pay my taxes, I have a job, I'm not lazy. And it's up to us as young people to really illustrate who we are, to redepict and reformulate these stereotypes. So these were just a few of the discussions that we had at the expert group meeting on Indigenous youth in New York City in January. The final report has been put online as well as in paper form, and I would like all of you, each and every one of you, to review the recommendations that we made. Because people say Indigenous youth are the future, but really we're leading the way today as well. So I'd like to remind you of that. Miigwech, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Landry. I'd now like to call on Mr. McConaway.
Thank you for the opportunity. For me, Setariki Madanawai from Fiji. And here, along with my Indigenous persons with disabilities, brothers and sisters from Australia, from Bangladesh, from Canada, from Mexico, from Nicaragua, from Kenya, and also from Greenland. This time last year, we were trying to sneak in. We were trying to be included. We were trying to be made visible. And we thank the UN Permanent Forum. We thank the Disability Rights Advocacy Fund. We thank the Government of Australia through AusAid and the International Disability Alliance for enabling us. As persons with disabilities, we are new to this movement, but we are Indigenous people. We are part of the Indigenous people's movement. And many a time our issues are left behind, swept under the carpet, remained out of agendas of our meetings because we are seen as valueless, worthless, and not useful members, contributing members of our community. We are here this year, and we thank the UN Permanent Forum for hearing our cry last year and supporting the report, a report to be presented on Wednesday in 2 days' time, and encourage the media to be there so that as the report is being presented and we acknowledge the leadership role of our chair at the 12th session of the Permanent Forum with Ms. Myrna Cunningham, who has kindly given the opportunity for one of our colleagues from Canada, sister from Canada, to help co-present the report. This is new to us as persons with disabilities, a space that we don't enjoy, but we should. A space that we are not allowed, but we should be given. So as persons with disabilities, this year we want to also have our own space within the Indigenous Peoples Movement, a caucus, and we thank those regions that have supported us. I'd like to name the Latin America, Caribbean, and also the Pacific, for supporting the need to establish a disability caucus. And I'm proud to announce today that we have formed one. We also, over the last couple of days, we have been meeting, and we also saw the need, as we are fighting our battle individually, sometimes in isolation, within our struggles, like young people, like women, we as people with disabilities, we're fighting that alone. But we need to learn from each other. So we have also established a network of Indigenous persons with disabilities, and we have also a steering committee. And we must thank again the Disability Rights Advocacy Fund and the International Disability Alliance for enabling us to do that. We, as Indigenous persons with disabilities, we need to be empowered, be enabled. Often the disability becomes our identity, and that should not be. As Indigenous people, we have a life to live. We have our human rights to enjoy. And we thank the UN Permanent Forum once again under the human rights agenda for including the discussion of the report. I'll continue to kindly remind our chair, Mr. Senna, I didn't hear you this morning talk about the report. There was no mention in any of the speakers talking about Indigenous persons with disabilities. We're not asking for much. We're asking to be included. We want to be part of the movement. Because often when we are not there, we're not seen, we're invisible, we're often locked away in the back room of our homes. We know that. Culturally, disability is seen as a disgrace, a shame, an embarrassment, a curse to our family in some of our traditional cultures. We want to change that. Like young people, like women, we have abilities, we have potentials to become contributing members of our community. And we welcome the opportunity. We thank once again those who have made it possible for us to be here, even at this table. We hardly given this opportunity. But when we do, we want to make the most of it because we want to be seen, we want to be heard, we want to be counted. And I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKenaway. I'd now like to call on Ms. Doro.
Kiana Soak. First of all, I'd like to congratulate Kanyinki Sena as the first Indigenous person from the African continent as the chair of the Permanent Forum, and also welcome the youth advocates. But it's my great honor also to be seated next to an advocate for the Indigenous Disability Caucus, and welcome you into the family of Indigenous peoples and the movement at the international level, and look forward to the contributions that you and many others can make to the ongoing dialogue concerning Indigenous peoples here within the UN. I'd also like to thank the journalists present. The work that you do is absolutely critical to saturating the airwaves with regard to the voice of Indigenous peoples. So these kinds of press conferences are absolutely critical to ensure that others around the globe hear about the issues that face Indigenous peoples. I want to just mention a couple of things that I believe should be focal points or highlights for this 12th session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. First and foremost is the discussion leading up to the World Conference in 2014. Kanyinki has mentioned this already. I think that the most critical issue and the most critical message that needs to be conveyed with regard to this high-level discussion with governments is their obligations, their solemn obligations under the Charter of the United Nations to promote the human rights and fundamental freedoms of all peoples, including indigenous peoples. And when I say they have solemn obligations, now that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples has been adopted in 2007, as most of you know, we have not seen enough concrete, proactive movement on the part of the nation states responsible for promoting and protecting the rights, the human rights of all peoples, but especially indigenous peoples. We've already heard about the marginalization in terms of the African continent, in terms of indigenous youth, in terms of disabled indigenous persons. But at the same time, all of us as an indigenous family remain marginalized in large part because states have not undertaken their solemn obligations to respect and recognize the human rights of indigenous peoples and have not taken concrete action to implement the standards embraced by the UN Declaration. And in many cases, this is an urgent matter. Even as I said last year at a press conference, the basic right to life as human beings is being challenged in different parts of the world. Most recently, I read the Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples' message concerning the violence in Ecuador. This is just one example of violence being perpetrated against indigenous peoples. The second message that I want to highlight is the pressure that indigenous peoples are facing in the context of extractive industries. And in many ways, and like the nature of human rights, in many ways this political violence is linked to extractive industries. And the political violence being perpetrated against indigenous peoples in order to get to the resources. And the lack of direct nation-state involvement in checking that kind of activity and regulating that kind of activity in favor of indigenous peoples. I think this is a critical message as well. The third and final thing that I want to mention is the range of side events that will take place, because there's much that takes place in the sort of gavel-to-gavel sessions of the Permanent Forum itself, the business and the review year activities that Kanyinki has laid out that are important, but also the side events. And in particular, one that I wanted to highlight is in relation to the Arctic. And many of you may have been reading in the press lately the movement of countries outside the circumpolar Arctic region to gain a voice within within the region and within our communities. Recently, the Arctic Council allowed for the permanent observer status of China, Singapore, and a number of other countries. The reason why I raise this issue is because it relates to the matter of extractive industries, but even more significantly, the rights of Arctic indigenous peoples to their lands, territories, and resources. And it is quite unfortunate, in my view, that the Arctic Council, though it's seen as a cutting-edge organization in terms of recognition of indigenous peoples as permanent participants within the fold of the Arctic Council, those Arctic Rim nation states that make up the membership of the Arctic Council have not actively and in a concrete or comprehensive fashion implemented the provisions of the Declaration, and may in fact be more willing on the basis of the pressures of outside economic forces like the government of China to yield to the agenda and the issues of a force like China over the interests and the rights of Arctic indigenous peoples. The Sami Parliament will be hosting a side event on May 28th, the second week of the Permanent Forum, looking at the rights of Sami to not only their lands, territories, and resources in terms of terra firma and on land, but also their offshore rights and their potential or the need, I should say, for recognition of their rights as sea-going peoples in terms of taking of fish stocks and so forth. And you can imagine from the government of Norway's perspective that this might be somewhat of a contentious issue because they safeguard their fishing industry in ways that are fairly aggressive, never mind the extractive industries in terms of oil and gas development in offshore areas. So I'll yield there, but I believe that there are a wide range of issues that require the focus of the members of the permanent forum, but we also have to be mindful of what we can achieve in terms of the World Conference in 2014, and also, as Kanyike has said, the post-2015 discussion, of which, again, indigenous peoples are at the fringe of many of these development goals and objectives. So I'll stop there and yield to the chair and the floor. Payanak.
Thank you very much, Ms. Doro. We'll now take your questions. Please introduce yourselves to our guests when you pose your question. Yes, please.
Charles, Baltic Review. In the preparatory meeting hosted by the Sami Parliament in Alta Norway during June and this May forum, do you know if the Finno-Ugric indigenous youth who are related to the Estonians, Finns, and Hungarians are being represented?
I think we can... I've not seen the full list of participants for the ALTA meeting, but I know about 300 indigenous people from every region of the world would be participating. So maybe we will need to follow up with you and really get into contact with people from the Sami Parliament who will be part of this permanent forum. Then we see how, or maybe we'll get you in touch with the global coordinating group and so that we can see whether that issue has been addressed.
I also know there's 57 participants selected from each region, and most regions probably have about 5 to 10 youth from each region. So hopefully they'll have that number represented within those youth as well.
Okay. Thank you. Next question.
Yes.
You had a question, George?
I don't know if I should say this in front of the whole forum. I'd like to ask... Ms. Landry, specifically, you talk about not being able to speak your own language and issues of this kind. Have you, and not being able to speak proudly of your heritage, do you have any experience dealing with people in two places, New Zealand and Mexico? New Zealand, the majority white Anglo government, as it were, makes a great point of saying, and I saw this when I was there, first time 40 years ago, the great debt we have to the indigenous Maori peoples in New Zealand. And the thing that occurs to me about Mexico is I remember also about around the same time when they were first planning the development, the tourist development in Cancun, I remember one of the things that struck me about it was the workforce in Cancun are not Hispanic. They're Mayan. They made a great point of saying when they eventually set up infrastructure and set up schools, they were going to require the learning for all students of the Mayan language in the schools. Have you dealt with in any way with any of these people, so perhaps learn something from their experience for your people in your country or in your little piece of Northwest Ontario?
I actually visited New Zealand in February, and I noticed a lot of different kinds of things going on in regards to teaching the language, whether it was through the Maori television or even just within the educational systems. But in Canada specifically, and I was talking to some of the other youth from North America, like such as the United States, and we don't have access to even a school in my community. We don't have a school in my community, so how are we expected to learn when that infrastructure isn't even there? So we have a very high lack of accessibility to educational mechanisms within our own communities, our Indigenous communities. But then you also look at the other side, where traditional knowledge doesn't need a school. You know, traditional knowledge doesn't need a big, large infrastructure where you spend millions of dollars to make. But the reality is, if you're living in survival mode on your reservation, it's minus 40 out, you don't know where you're going to get your next meal, are you really going to have the time or the energy to learn your language? We have so many issues within our Indigenous communities that we as young people are trying to overcome, but a lot of us tend to move to the cities to fit into the Western society of success. And that's one of the key barriers as Indigenous youth, you know, how to find that balance between both worlds so we can learn the language and we can also, you know, still survive in society in general. So I have seen the work done in New Zealand, but I think that it's quite different in Canada specifically, especially in the more isolated communities. You know, a lot of our communities are fly-in. The Canadian government doesn't offer much support for education as of right now for Indigenous peoples. And if they were to offer dollars for education, it would not be Indigenous specific. It would be regular Western educational systems. So that's where the barriers really lay.
Matthew Lee, Inner City Press. I was interested by, I see in the agenda you're dealing with the World Bank operational policies. And if you could say a little bit more where you think the review is going, particularly if there are particular projects that you think are a problem that they funded. And also, is the International Monetary Fund on your radar? Are they going to be reviewed in this session or not?
The World Bank has about 10 operational policies. And the one that touches on Indigenous peoples is Operation Policy Number 4.0. But they wanted to kind of consolidate all these policies in such a way that it also responds to the various interests. They started that process about a year ago. They're saying it will take about 2 years, so it's still a process of dialogue. But Indigenous peoples are still insisting that they need a standalone policy as it has always been, and even they need that improved. For example, issues of free, prior, and informed consultation, we want that to be changed. Because the World Bank says free, prior, informed consultation leading to broad community support. But Indigenous peoples are insisting that it should be free, prior, informed consent, which is a guideline that the IFC, the International Financial Corporation, has a language that the IFC has adopted. So it's still an ongoing discussion, and they're meeting here. In fact, they have a meeting on Thursday morning. That Thursday morning, they'll focus on the African region. I think the meeting, I'll get in touch if you can follow up on this so that you can be part of it. Of course, we understand that in the African context, for example, the World Bank has actually had a very negative impact to Indigenous peoples in most cases because they rarely consult them. But we are happy that now this discussion is going on, and we hope that something fruitful will come out of it. And we also see now the African Development Bank trying to go the direction the World Bank is going, and they have even already sent one of their representatives here.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Thank you. Sorry. Afakanjo with South South News. I guess it's very specific, just of course on the notion that without language we don't have culture, which is very true and relevant. But I was just wondering, maybe, and of course the call from top-down efforts from governments and leaders, etc. But I'm just wondering more on grassroots level, efforts as well from the bottom up. In terms of, just so I was curious, when you grew up, were there not, let's say, churches or community centers or places of worship, whatever they may be for you, where you could have been taught the language, for example, from a toddler age, from parents, grandparents, what have you? Where was the missing link there? What happened?
In Canada specifically, we had the residential school system, and children were apprehended from their First Nations communities, from their traditional territories, and placed into church-run schools. And they were abused if they spoke their language, they were tortured, they were raped, and that's where the cutoff was. So my grandfather, for example, attended one of those schools. When he came back, he was ashamed to speak his language. And basically it was taught in young Indigenous children in Canada that if they spoke the language, they were going to hell. So you still have this concept within the generation, so that the generation cutoff happened. You know, my grandfather lost all that connection. He didn't pass any of it on to my mother, but she learned herself because it was her will, it was her passion, it's in her heart. And she passed on as much as she could to me. But that's where the cutoff was. And that's where we as young people are trying to overcome those obstacles and trying to gain pride in who we are in our languages and our traditions and our cultures. Yet when you go speak to some of the elders in our communities, they won't speak about it. Mm-hmm. So that's where the healing has to take place, and that's where we have to continue having these kind of dialogues.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to say it was an intentional policy on the part of the Government of Canada mm-hmm. and aided and abetted by the churches. I think that's important to mm-hmm. be factual about
the legislation that. Was stated that it was meant to kill the Indian and the child. They wanted to get rid of all the Indians and the children to make Indian children assimilated, and that was the legislation specifically in Canada. That was specifically in 1878. It was first established, and the last residential school closed in 1996.
Any further questions?
Quick question for you, if I may. Ms. Landry spoke of this great report which is coming out, which you hope we will all read. Is that out yet, or is that, did I hear, coming out later in the week?
You have to ask my colleagues in the forum.
It is available right now. It's available online, and there should be copies in the forum as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Matthew.
Just one more question. There's pretty recent, this is a pretty recent decision, so I don't know if it's on your agenda or not, but in Guatemala, this finding of genocide against Rios Montt and the Mayan, primarily against Mayan communities. Do you expect, has there been any kind of resonance among in the permanent forum of this, first finding of a head of state to have actually ordered genocide against, in this case, an indigenous community? Do you have any either comment on that, or do you think expect it to come up in this week?
I'm unsure if it'll come up this week, but what I want to say about it is it's groundbreaking in terms of the attachment of genocide and crimes against humanity being tagged directly to an individual in the indigenous people's context. Historically, everyone has regarded genocide as even, in fact, taboo to talk about within the indigenous context. But if you think about what was described in terms of the residential schools, not to mention the outright, killing of Aboriginal people in Tasmania or any number of other countries, so this is important in terms of recognizing the acts, the intent, and so forth, hopefully, in terms of the equal application of the rule of law in the context of a peremptory norm of international law, that something will come of it in terms of directing the world's attention to this historical reality concerning indigenous peoples. And it's not just Guatemala. I mean, we can go practically anywhere in the world. And that's one reason why I reference the political violence being perpetrated against indigenous peoples mm-hmm. here and now. Not something of a historical nature, but here and now. And so in terms of the basic right to life, these are still urgent issues.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you introduce yourself, please?
Mm-hmm. We can't hear you too well. Sorry.
Can you speak up?
Can you move on?
Come forward.
Yeah. The mic.
Thank you.
This may have been in the last century, the early part of this century, but I know that the Mapuche Indian tribe in Chile was decimated, I believe, the Native and the British sent smallpox infested blankets to them, and they were introduced, alcohol was introduced to them, so they ended up basically being, what was left of them, being essentially unable to function. And I know that there was a lot of work being done by Jose Antonio Erwin, who was the son of the first democratically elected president after Pinochet in Chile, he was doing a lot of work with the Mapuches, so I don't know whether anybody here is addressing that issue. I would believe that practice of sending smallpox infested diamond blankets was even done in this country. I was thinking particularly of Chile, and is anything being done to investigate genocide?
I believe that they may be, you know, the way the forum operates is that the regional caucuses develop their statements. So if there will be Mapuche representatives in this meeting, they should be able to include their issues in that, especially what you've discussed on alcoholism, that will come within the topic of health, for example. So maybe they would be able to include their issues there so that the forum can develop recommendations. Mm-hmm. But I would also urge you to directly look for the Mapuche activists who might be here, and I'm sure they are because there's a big delegation from Latin America. Look for them, have this dialogue with them, and please make sure that some of those issues go into their statement so that we can include them as part of the forum's recommendations.
Thank you. Any other questions? Any panelists? Anyone like to make a closing remark?
I want to make a closing remark, having been asked no question. I'm not sure if it's because of the newness or of the issue of indigenous person disabilities, but there is also the UN RIP, the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Persons, in Article 21-22. There's a reference to indigenous person disabilities. And there's also the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. That's recently adopted by the UN in 2006, where indigenous persons disabilities is mentioned in the preamble. Now, my take on this is that we are referenced in both, probably most better referenced in the UN RIP. The danger is then when we fit in both worlds, in the UN RIP, featuring the appearing there and also being mentioned, referenced in the disability human rights treaty. Now, then often it either be then we are and end up nowhere being mentioned in both. So there is really then a need for inclusion. As we talk indigenous people's issues, that there be included, that indigenous people's disabilities, like youth, like women, are included. That approach towards how we address indigenous people's issues are inclusive. Same with the disability community movement and the issues. They too need to be inclusive in the way they approach and address issues, instead of embracing the women and addressing also indigenous persons' disabilities. So I guess for us moving forward, my humble proposition is that disability is not something to be afraid about. Disabilities are people first, but disability second, and they have a lot of potential to make. So the report of the UN Permanent Forum that's coming out on Wednesday is something that I'll ask you, the media, to grab hold of and then share that story. And also there is a side event on the same day at the main conference room. So there is really a wonderful opportunity, and thanks to the UN Permanent Forum for bringing disability into the center stage. For many a time, we're the margin of society. We are left in the back burner. We are often not thought about or included for the sake of being included. So really, the opportunity is here, and I thank the media. Thank the UN Permanent Forum. I thank the chair for your leadership in this, and to my colleagues on the panel for the support. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. McConaway. And would you like to say a word, Mr. Senator?
First of all, I would like to say thank you for all of you to have found time to come to listen to us. The media is very, very critical in whatever we do. We really seek your support and partnership in this. It's very encouraging that the questions that I've heard most of you talk about were not really questions, but directing us towards opportunities that we can use. For example, the examples you gave about languages and etc. This is very, very critical. And just to support what my colleague with representing the disability groups has said, we are committed, actually, as a permanent forum this year to bring a lot of publicity into issues of indigenous peoples with disability, because they have been neglected for quite a while, for long. We understand that since the forum started working, about only two recommendations towards issues of indigenous peoples with disabilities have been developed, which is actually quite local, understanding that indigenous people with disabilities suffer all these challenges. So we urge you to really be part of this effort to bring attention into issues of indigenous peoples with disabilities. So kindly remember that on Wednesday morning we are presenting a report that we've developed on indigenous people's disabilities, and then on that Wednesday lunchtime from 1:15, they have a side event. But I'll also urge you to spread this message of the permanent forum. What we are doing here is not actually fighting our governments, because in Africa, for example, there's always that misconception that we are here to complain. No, we didn't come to complain, but we are trying to look for solutions that can also support even those governments in trying to address issues of concern to indigenous peoples. And I would urge correspondents based in Africa who are part of this room to actually take some time and visit indigenous communities to see the challenges they face, for example, in relation to extractive industries. And maybe just to name a few, one, you can visit the Olkaria Geothermal Development Project. It's about only an hour and a half from Nairobi. You would see what's happening there to the Maasai community. You'd also want to go and see what's happening with the oil industry in around Lake Turkana in northern Kenya, coupled with the Gibe Dam that is being constructed in Ethiopia, and how indigenous peoples in both Kenya and Ethiopia are being excluded and punished in the process. I'd also like you people to follow up the discussions and the developments of the Lapset Corridor connecting, they call it the Equatorial Land Bridge, and part of it is the Lapset Corridor connecting Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, and finally Cameroon and Chad. Very interesting. All this will pass through indigenous people's territories, and indigenous people are not part of these discussions. We also see in Tanzania, for example, in Loliondo, we see the government trying to get indigenous peoples out of this land to bring in Arab hunters, which is not the way to go, because conservation has been possible in Loliondo because of the way the pastoralist life of the Maasai that actually lives in its harmony with nature. So sending them away would not be a solution. So we ask you to publicize this message with an intention of actually enabling dialogue between indigenous peoples and governments and other partners. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you want to say anything? Okay, I think we will close this press conference. I'd like to thank all of our guests for joining us today, and thank all of you for coming. Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.